out to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical-grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and cultural insights. This is one of the several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
Hello, we're going to be in Mark chapter 8 today, the feeding of the 4,000. There is much discussion about, are there two feedings, one of 4,000 and one of 5,000, or is it just one feeding from two perspectives? I've made a graphic for you of the similarity and differentness between the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000, and I would like to look at that just for a minute. I think it'll help us see what we're talking about. Now, there are some similarities. They're both in wilderness areas. Jesus asked how many loaves. Jesus asked the crowd to sit down on the grass and get ready to eat, and he gave thanks and broke the bread. But there are also some differences. The number of loaves involved, the number of the crowd, who asked the question about the food, and the size of the baskets that collected the food that's left over. The earlier account was small baskets, little knapsacks, like a lunch pail. But this is the word basket that means the same kind of basket that Paul was lifted over the wall in Damascus with. It's a huge basket, a hamper basket, we might think. So I really think they're two different accounts, even though they're very, very similar. It seems that Jesus fed a large group twice out of his compassion for them. Now let's go to chapter 8. We're still in the area of the Decapolis, and we learn from chapter 7, verse 31. Now, of course, that's the area of the Gadarene demoniac. In those days, when a great crowd again had gathered, and they had nothing to eat, he called the disciples to him and said, "My heart goes out in pity for these people, for they've been staying with me for 3 days now, and they have nothing left to eat." Well, these folks, think of this now. We get tired in our churches at 12:05. These folks stayed 3 days to hear him preach. Wouldn't you? Don't you wish there was an audio cassette of his sermon for 3 days? Wouldn't you love to hear Jesus teach for 3 days? Well, these folks had eaten all their lunches that they brought, and they'd begun fasting. There was women and children. 3 days now. What a long, extended period. And aren't you glad Jesus had pity and compassion on them? Boy, that says something about who he is, I think. He's also trying to build the disciples' faith in this instance. Now, "And if I send them home hungry, they will give out on the road." Now, the word "give out" means faint because of lack of food. Now, this word is used in the Septuagint in two different passages. Judges 8:15, and you ought to see Lamentations 2:19 especially. Jesus said, they can't make it home, they're so hungry. "For some of them are a long way from home. But his disciples said, where can we get any bread enough here in this destitute place?" Now, what he's saying is, even if we had the money, there's no place to buy the bread. Friends, there weren't any totems in that day, 7-Elevens, you know. They had to bake it, and they had to have the resources, had to have the oven. It was impossible to get food out there. There were just no resources, even if the money was available. And they were telling Jesus this, to give this people plenty. And he asked them, "How many loaves do you have?" And they said, 7. And so he ordered the crowd to sit down on the ground. The word here means recline. Now, when they ate, they reclined on their left elbow. And so what he's telling them, get ready to eat. We might say, put the napkin around your neck, friends. We're going to eat. And I'm sure the disciples are looking at each other. "He took the 7 loaves. He gave thanks and broke them in pieces and gave them to the disciples to pass." Now, the give thanks, of course, he would raise his hands and his eyes toward heaven. And this giving thanks at mealtime is a recognition of God's provision and care for us, even in the everyday occurrences of life. It's a very beautiful thing. Now, when it says he broke it, that's aorist tense. But when he says he gave them to the disciples, that's in perfect tense. So the miracle of multiplication happened in the hand of Jesus. He broke a loaf and gave them some, and broke a loaf and gave them some, and there was never a lack of bread to give. So the miracle happened right there in Jesus' hands. Now, let's see. "And he gave them to pass out, and they passed them out to the people, and they had a few small fish." Now, you remember that these people don't eat like we do. They ate meat maybe once or twice a month. I ate a lot of fish, a lot of vegetables, a lot of bread. And so a few fish and hard rolls was what they were used to. If you've gone to Europe or Israel lately, you know how hard the bread is they serve. It stays longer. You know, there's no Mrs. Baird soft bread for them at all. So they were. This was just a normal diet, nothing fancy. Jesus wasn't feeding them lobster. He was feeding them hamburgers, if you please. And he blessed them and told them to pass these to the people. And they ate and had plenty. And they took up pieces left over, of which seven hamper baskets. Now these, you don't see Acts 9:25. This is the word for Paul being led over the wall in Damascus. Now the word baskets in the earlier account is a small knapsack they carried in their belt, like a lunch pail for us. Okay? Now, and about 4,000 people were there. Now from Matthew 15:28, it says 4,000 men. Now if it is 4,000 men, we're talking about a larger, much larger group than 4,000, possibly up to 7, 8, 9,000, you know, if we count women and children. So there's a lot of people there. And he sent them away. And at once he got into the boat and crossed to the district of Dalmatha. Now, Matthew 15:39 has Magdan, and it's on the Sea of Galilee. Now, look at verse 11. This is so interesting to me because the Pharisees are going to come and intersperse here. Now, the Pharisees came out and began, present tense, a discussion with him to test him. Now, there are two words in Greek for test. There's a word that means to test with a view toward approval or affirmation. It's often used of God. And there is a word that means to test or attempt or try with a view toward destruction. Now, the Pharisees here are trying to test him with a view toward his destruction. And they ask him to show them a spectacular sign from heaven. Now, this spectacular sign, in the Gospel of John, this Greek word has a... This is the word we get the English word sign from. It has a specialized meaning of a power sign that John then interprets the meaning. The Gospel of John is based around seven of these miracles and their interpretation. But here in the Synoptic Gospels, and it's going to be hard for us to catch this, but what they're really wanting, they're wanting some kind of prediction, not a miracle, because they've seen Jesus do miracles. Him doing a miracle, they've seen that. They want him to predict the future in some way. You say, well, why? In the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 13, 2 through 5, and Deuteronomy 18, 18 through 22, the test for a prophet was if the prediction comes through. Now, what they were trying to do, they're trying to test Jesus' authority. Where does he get his power? And so they're trying to put the Old Testament test for a prophet on Jesus. But he sighed in spirit. The word here is groaned. How long? You know, that kind of idea. Why do the people of these times ask for a spectacular sign? What he's trying to say is, I've shown you sign after sign after sign. The deaf are hearing, the blind are seeing, the poor are being ministered to. I'm teaching the things of God. What other kind of sign could you possibly want? See, they were spiritually blind, and all the miracles in the world wouldn't open their eyes to their preconceived bias about what God should do and how he should do it and through whom he should do it. Now, then he says, I solemnly say no sign will be given them. Now, if you'll look at Matthew 16:4, it mentions except the sign of Jonah. Now, I think this is not a contradiction so much as a fuller account in Matthew. What Jesus is saying is, I will not give you any more signs than you already have. Now, when he mentions Jonah, I think it's Jonah 1:17 that he's talking about, probably about 3 days in the belly of the whale, which is going to be used for the idea of Jesus in the tomb 3 days. Now, these people have no idea what he means by Jonah at this point. Now, he already knows about his death, his burial, his going to Hades, and his resurrection, because he predicts it right here when he's talking about Jonah. Now, verse 13, and he left them and got into a boat and crossed to the other side. Now, when they had... Now, they had forgotten to bring the bread. You see, there was basketfuls left over. And Jesus didn't perform these miracles regularly, like they just didn't walk along and Jesus say, poof, and here's a hamburger, y'all eat. He didn't do this regularly. It was very unusual for him to do it, really because it was one of the temptation experiences. You know, feed the world and they'll follow you. And unfortunately, that was true, but for all the wrong reasons. So Jesus didn't do this often. So they collected the bread and they used it to eat on for the next few days. But the disciples forgot to bring the bread in the boat. They must have left it on the shore. And now they're arguing about who forgot the bread. It's your responsibility, Peter. You should have got it. No, it's your responsibility. You should have got it. And here they are arguing over the bread. You know, what are they going to eat? They left the bread. That is, they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he kept warning them by saying, look out, keep on guard yourselves against the yeast of the Pharisees and the yeast of Herod. Now, let's look at this. They're talking about bread. So Jesus picks up on this about saying, be careful of the yeast or the leaven of the Pharisees. Now, the word leaven or yeast and the word word in Aramaic is exactly the same except for the last letter. And the last letter is pronounced very similarly. Now, I think Jesus was saying, be careful of the words of the Pharisees. And they were thinking about bread and heard him say leaven of the Pharisees. Either way, anyway, he's warning them. This word look out is a present imperative, and the word guard yourself is a present imperative. They had just tried to trick him. They just tried to get him to make a mistake or to prove them who he was. And Jesus is conscious of the spiritual things that are happening, and the disciples are worried about what they're going to have for lunch. They're worried about the physical things, and Jesus is still trying to convey to them these spiritual things. Now, verse 16. So they were discussing one another. Now, this is imperfect tense. They were discussing over and over and over and over again. What about the bread? Who forgot the bread? What are we going to eat? Over and over. They had no bread. And as he noticed it, he said to them, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet know or understand? Are your minds so dull? Since you have eyes, can you not see with them? And since you have ears, can you not hear with them? Do you not remember how many basketfuls of pieces were picked up when I broke the five loaves in pieces for the 5,000? And they said, 12. And how many hamperfuls of pieces when I broke the seven loaves in pieces for the 4,000? They said, 7. And he said to them, how is it that you do not understand? Now, catch this picture. Jesus had been trying to work with the faith of the disciples. He had just finished feeding all these people. And now, they're worried about lunch? If Jesus can take a few loaves and feed thousands, the disciples are worried about the provision for lunch? Now, do you catch the irony of this? You know, isn't this just like us? They were right there. They saw the miracles. They walked with the Lord. And yet, it is if they had no spiritual understanding. He would do these marvelous things. He'd ask them a question. They'd go, da-da-da-da-da. Isn't it like us today? We see these things of God, we experience His love, and we still walk on our own resources and worry about are we going to have lunch or not. Friends, Jesus, who broke the loaves for the 4,000, is going to provide for you. Okay, we're going to get set up for a map shot in just a second, and we're going to be moving to the next major event, if you would please, which is going to be they're going to another village. Now, they're going to be along the Sea of Galilee in several different places. I'm going to show you those in just a second on this map. We're going to, if you have a map in the back of your Bible, you probably want to turn there and turn to a page where it's a view of Palestine. And I'll let you be looking for two different cities on your own just for a minute. The city of, verse 22, Bethsaida. Now, Bethlehem means house of bread. Bethsaida means house of fish. And there are several villages by that name. We don't know exactly where this was. It could have been any village if you want to. And then a little bit later, we're going to go to Caesarea Philippi, which is about 25 miles north. Well, north-northwest, the Sea of Galilee, and that's where these next two events are going to occur. So let's look at the map for a moment then, if we could. Let me point these out to you. You see Bethsaida right there, and then going straight north of Bethsaida, quite a ways up, you see Caesarea Philippi. Now, this was the area that Herod Antipas, you see, Herod Antipas had this area and this area, Perea and Galilee. But this area is the territory of Philip. And there was less Jews there, and I'm sure Jesus felt that he'd get away with the disciples and have a little quiet time. It's not going to happen, but that's what he wanted. Now, they came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to him and begged him to touch him. And he took him by the hand and led him outside the village. Now, notice this is just the same as happened in chapter 7. Jesus wanted to get away from the crowd, get by himself. Now, either because he did not want to be known as a healer or because he wanted to get the man a little more relaxed situation. And, of course, this is a messianic sign. The very sign they're asking for in verse 11 is the very thing he's doing all the way through here. It's amazing to me they just didn't see it. Causing the blind to see is a messianic promise of Isaiah 35. Now, Let's see, led him out to the village, and he spit in his eyes and laid hands upon him. You may say, yuck, he spit in his eyes? Now, friends, you just can't judge the New Testament by your day. Saliva was used for medicinal purposes. The man couldn't see. Jesus is trying to communicate faith to him. He wants to show the man that he wants to heal him. So how would he communicate besides talking? Well, if someone spit in your eyes and you were blind, I think you'd get the idea if it's Jesus and they told they're going to take him to a healer and ask him to heal him, and some guy spits in your eyes, I think you'd put two and two together and say, hey, I think I'm here, right? Jesus does that, lays hands on him, and he says, do you see anything? Notice, he looked up and answered, I see the people, but they look to me like trees moving around. You can't imagine what the commentators do with this. They say, well, Jesus didn't fully heal him, and Jesus didn't have complete power, and this was a tough case. It's not a tough case. I think Jesus is working with the faith of people. This man could see a little. He just was honest. He says, you know, Jesus, I see, but that just looked like tree trunks moving around. I can't see real clear. Jesus is working with this man's faith. The spitting in the eyes, the laying on of hand were Jewish practices. Saliva and laying on hands, normal practice. And now he says, can you see? And the man says, I can see a little bit. Jesus says, come on. And he prays for him again, lays hands on him, and the man sees completely. I don't see anything here, but the fact that we can't fully explain the method and the manner of Jesus' healing. Now, Jesus could speak, we learned last week, from miles away, a demon was cast out with no ritual whatsoever. Jesus didn't even say, come out. He just said, it's happened. Go see. And here, he has to do it twice to heal a blind man. This is not Jesus being limited. This is Jesus working with the faith of this blind man. We just can't make dogmatic rules about how Jesus did things. And we only have such a small part of Jesus' ministry recorded in the Gospels. Okay, then he laid hands upon his eyes again, looked and best he could, and was cured, and saw everything distinctly. And let's look at verse 26. So he sent him home with a warning, do not ever go into the village. Now, that's a bad translation. Jesus isn't saying, don't ever go back to this town. What he's saying is, don't go right now, you go home. Jesus did not want this man spreading the news that he had cured him. He had enough problems with crowds, and it is. He's trying to get away from these crowds, and he doesn't need everybody saying, oh, this guy healed me. So he says, now go on home. I'm thrilled death for you. Don't tell anybody. It's this messianic secret in Mark, found so often. Okay. Now, verse 27. Then Jesus and his disciples left Galilee and went to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. Now, this is north of the Sea of Galilee, about 25 miles or so. Philip's territory, another son of Herod the Great. And on the way there, he was asking his disciples, imperfect tense. He was talking to them over and over about this. Who do people say that I am? Now, in Matthew 16:13, he says, they say the Son of Man is. And if you, that Son of Man is very interesting. It comes from the Old Testament where it means human being. But in Daniel 7:13, it takes on connotations of deity. Jesus chose this term because it was not used by rabbinical Judaism, and yet it still had the connotations of humanity and deity combined. Okay? Now, here's what they're going to say. They answered him. Some say John the Baptist. Now, that's what Herod Antipas thought when he had him killed. Remember, John the Baptist had him killed? Thought Jesus was simply resurrected. That's Herod's view, Mark 6:16. Some say Elijah. Now, why Elijah? Well, back in Malachi 4:5, Elijah is going to be the forerunner of the prophet. I mean, of the Messiah. And so some say he's the forerunner of the Messiah. Others say you're one of the prophets. Now, from Matthew 16:14, we learn that some say Jeremiah. All of these involve a resurrection. The parallel in Luke 9:19 is the same thing. All of them are miraculous, honorific titles. But friends, we can't say nice things about Jesus. We can't say he's just a prophet or a great man, religious leader. We've got to come to a greater definition of who he is, a greater faith, and that's what he's coming to when he says, he began to ask them, who do you yourself say I am? You is plural. He's talking to all of the apostolic group. Who do you yourselves say I am? Peter answers for the group. You are the Christ. Now, the parallels, Matthew 16:16-19. Now, the word Christ is the Greek equivalent of the Hebrew term Messiah that means the anointed one. Prophets, priests, and kings were anointed with olive oil as a special sign of the choosing, equipping, and empowering of God for a particular task. Now, but he strictly warned them not to tell this to anybody. There's that messianic secret. Why? The gospel is not finished. Jesus has not died. There's nothing to tell yet that's really significant. He's healed some people. He's loved some people. He's revealed truth. He's had marvelous teachings. But he came to give his life a ransom for many. And that's not yet. So he says, don't tell anybody. Why? Because there were such poor, poor cultural connotations within rabbinical Judaism of the office and the function and the type of God's Messiah. Jesus did not fit that nationalistic, militaristic image. And so he said, don't tell anybody. Then he instructed them for the first time that the Son of Man had to endure great suffering. Now, before I go to verse 31, let me just say to you. Notice that Mark, we believe, recorded the recollections of Peter. Mark records an eyewitness account, and Mark wasn't one of the apostles. Isn't it funny that Peter leaves off Jesus' praise for him? Doesn't even mention it. Isn't that something? This was not a good day for Peter. He spoke up and answered. But friend, he's going to put both feet in his mouth and then move them around a little bit. So he didn't even mention Jesus saying, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah. Didn't even mention that at all. Then Jesus instructed them for the first time that the Son of Man, there's that beautiful title, see Daniel 7:13, had, that's dia, must, moral necessity, to endure great suffering and to be disowned by the elders and the high priests and the scribes. The Jews could not believe the Messiah would suffer. The Greeks rejected the resurrection, but the Jews rejected a suffering Messiah. They had never equated Isaiah 53 with our Genesis 3:15 with the Messiah, apparently. So, this suffering aspect. Now, you ought to see Mark 10:45. Jesus said, I came to give my life a ransom for many. He came to die. He knew that. This is the first time he had clearly told them, not in parables, not in symbols, just outright said, I'm going to die. I'm going to be disowned. The word means to be disapproved, to be rejected by the elders, high priests, and scribes. This is the technical designation for the ruling council of the Jews, the Supreme Court of the Jews in Jerusalem, known as the Sanhedrin, made up of 70 local elders and important Jewish leaders. And the high priest of that day was its lead. Now, and be killed. No question, he's going to die. And rise again after 3 days. Now, the Targum relate this 3 days to Hosea 6, 1 and 2. But I already think because Jesus has earlier referred to Jonah, that probably we're looking at Jonah 1, 17. There's not much in the Old Testament about Jesus being in the tomb 3 days. It's a very vague thing. Verse 32, and without any reserve, he was telling them this fact. No parables, no symbolism, and it's imperfect tense. He was telling them over and over, plain language, straightforward. Boys, I'm going to die. I want you to know it before it happens. Now listen to this, what happened. The Jews were looking for a predictive sign, right? The sign was always there with the healing of the blind, the healing of the dumb. Those were signs of the Messiah. The Jews wanted a spectacular sign, which I told you meant a prediction. Jesus is giving to these disciples the spectacular sign that the Pharisees had earlier asked for. He's going to predict what's going to happen. Why is he doing that? To show the disciples who he is, to build faith in those men that when he died, they would hang in there and trust, knowing that Jesus had predicted it and that his other promises were true. Now, notice here. So Peter took him aside and began to reprove him. The way that Jesus took that blind man aside, Peter grabbed his arm and said, I won't talk to you a minute, Lord. Now, Peter was very sincere. Peter had good motives. He's just doing things like all of us would thought he should have, except he was doing it in his human understanding. And he's going to try to be Jesus' big brother and tell Jesus what he really ought to do. Now, isn't that ironic? You know, Peter's the kind of guy, if you can't think of something to do, stick one foot in your mouth. You know, that's the kind of guy he is. Now, notice where it says, and he turned at a glance at the disciples and reproved Peter by saying, get out of my way, Satan, for this view of yours is not from God but from men. Isn't it interesting that Peter's remembrance, he forgot Jesus' acclamation, but he remembered Jesus' rebuke. Satan was using Peter. How? Listen to me now. Listen to me. Remember the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness that Satan kept saying how to use your messianic powers? Well, Peter is tempting Jesus the same way to go another way than the cross. So Satan's using Peter in that same line of temptation. Now, Jesus had tried to feed the 5,000 and 4,000, which is one of those temptations, but Jesus went ahead and did it anyway. Now, Notice in verse 34, and he called to the people. Mark is the only place that tells us there was a crowd of people plus the disciples present at Caesarea Philippi. Called all them to him along with the disciples and said to them, if anyone wants to be my disciple, this is very important, come after me. He must say no to self, put the cross on his shoulders, and keep on following me. Now, this idea about say no is an aorist middle. He himself, aorist middle imperative, he himself must once and for all say no to self, deny himself, take up his cross. Now, these men knew what a cross meant. This wasn't some little piece of jewelry around your neck. This was a cruel, criminal execution. He's talking about dying to self. In this context, you'll see Matthew 10 where the parallel is. Keep on following, present imperative, me, not my teachings, not me, personal, person-centered. For whoever wants to save his, now mine has higher life and lower life, but really it's the word suke. It's a play on the word suke. Now, it's all the way through here the same word, but Jesus is using it in two senses, a physical life and spiritual life. For what benefit would it be to a man to gain the whole cosmos, the whole created order, and fail to gain his higher life? What Jesus is saying is, you can have everything materially, everything physically, and still lose the best, the most significant, which is spiritual life. For what price can a man give to buy back life? Whoever is ashamed of me, you ought to see Luke 12, 8 and 9, Matthew 10, 32 and 33. Whoever is ashamed of me now and my teachings in this unfaithful and sinful age, this is the Jewish view of two ages, the current evil age, the messianic age to come, then the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes back in his Father's splendor with the holy angels. Now that's the second coming. That's the parousia. Now, if we're ashamed now, he's going to be ashamed of us then. But this whole section is a beautiful, beautiful, this little about the come with the holy angels. Y'all see Daniel 7:10. Now, friends, what we're saying here is life is important. The choice you make now about who Jesus Christ is what's significant. You can't say he's a great prophet or a wonderful teacher or a great man. He's either got to be God incarnate or he is a liar. When Peter said, thou art the Christ, you're the Messiah, you're the promised one, you're the hope-for one, you're the deliverer, Jesus said, right, Peter, you're right. But then Peter immediately tried to define the Messiah's office in terms of his physical understanding that someone shouldn't die. Folks, when we come and know Jesus Christ and his fullness and relationship, we're going to lay down our physical life for others that we might develop and mature that spiritual life that God gives. This is not works righteousness. We're going to lay down our life because of that relationship that's always already been established by grace through faith. But once that relationship is established, then we lay our lives down for Him. This idea of taking up a cross doesn't mean your little pet peeve that you bear. What it means is you put your life down and let Him live His life through you. Folks, there's a lot of people in our world who have the things of this world. But in reality, they have nothing. For this world and all the things of this world are passing away. And the only thing that will last is the things of God and our relationship with Christ. Think about that. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again same time, same place next week. God bless you.